There's a film in that. There's a film in that. There's a film in that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn if there's a film in that.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 of There's a Film in That.
What's in the box?
I think there's a film in that box.
The podcast where three friends are going on a wild adventure to create the world's first ever podcast-written feature film. As always, with me here in the studio are the bad and the ugly to my good. Ryan.
Hey, Blondie.
And Tiernan.
I could have been a contender.
How are you guys doing?
Yeah, not too bad.
All right.
Busy weeks?
Pretty busy, yeah.
Are you all recovered from our first ever podcast, Night Out?
Taffet Night Out.
Only just. I think I probably will actually probably go for a drink soon.
Out and about in London town last Saturday.
Mm. Yeah.
For Wolfpack.
Yep. Yes. Exciting concert night out.
Yeah.
It was banging.
Very
it?
Inspiring.
Yeah.
Great music. Kind of almost reminded me of our podcast. Seemed very loose, very freestyle-y, very...
But, you know, full of genius.
Full yeah. of genius at the
Absolutely,
same time,
yeah.
exactly.
Anyway, so it's been a busy week for us all, I think.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so we won't dawdle on that, but we will get into... well, firstly, I think there's nothing to discuss in Cliffhanger Corner.
I can't believe we remembered everything, didn't leave any cliffhangers.
I think we just had decent Wi-Fi last week.
Maybe,
that's true. Yeah, I think we answered most of the questions on air. So we can move straight into the jingle-free recommendations corner.
Hey, what am I thinking about? I like to watch things. I see things on TV, then I tell everyone about it, and I'm in a corner.
Nice.
Very good.
So that's a jingle we've been working on for a while. So what have you guys been watching, reading?
So, well, we'll go through what we did recommend, which was firstly the Truman Show script. Anyone have a crack at that? I had read it before, but anyone have a crack at that?
Without actually, like, I went on a Google hunt to find it, and I couldn't find what I couldn't find. I couldn't find as a PDF. Maybe I just wasn't looking in the right place, but it was all. If I went on to like IMDb or something like that, it just tells you quotes, so I couldn't really see much outside of that.
Well, that's because you're not very good at the internet. I found three different versions.
Put you in your place there, hasn't it?
Without a huge amount of trouble.
I mean, I spent about 10 to 30 seconds looking for it, so...
I was going to say, if you said minutes, I was going to shoot you down there.
I did. I struggled to find potentially the very original screenplay, but I found Andrew Niccol's screenplay, and then I found a shooting first draft, and then I found what I assume was the final draft, and I decided to read them all. Just to see what the differences were like. Because I had never sat and read a script before. So that was a new experience for me.
Did you do it in one go?
I did. I tried to as much as I could because there were three and there were lots of emails and phone calls coming in. So there were interruptions. But I was channeling Ryan throughout the reading, which actually was more disruptive probably than just answering the phone. Sat there going, Ryan won't let me not read this in one go.
Was there like a little
Every
cloud?
Character took on Ryan's face.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
The Mercier Show.
Yeah.
I think my favourite bit was the fact that all names are in capital letters. Didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty exciting. No, but it was fascinating. So you've read it before. There's a huge difference between the original screenplay and the film. Loads of differences. Mm. But we don't want to get into too many spoilers, I suppose, in case people want to read it themselves. But it's not set in the same place.
I mean,
it's set in New York City.
I mean, what?
What? Exactly.
Is there a way we can link a link?
Link a link?
To Taffet?
Yeah, I think we can probably tweet a link to the screenplay.
Holy shit, let's do
That's
that.
That's a thing that exists.
Yeah,
we could do that. So, and then, and like I say, and we did recommend, I think the other thing we did was recommend just read any script.
Mm.
And I know every year now they release the Oscar screenwriting scripts and everything like that for people to read after the event and everything. So for anyone still not done yet but interested to, just type in your favourite film and I'm sure eventually you'll find either a transcript or the original script somewhere on there.
Try
it's well worth doing.
Mm. Try to spend more than 10 to 30 seconds doing it like I did.
I would recommend maybe just, and we'll put a link to two of them though, because I found it really fascinating how much it changed between the writer's version, then obviously what, you know, and I don't really understand how that process works. You guys can probably explain it better, but...
Well, how it gets changed?
Yeah, I mean, they obviously must bring other writers on board, but so when you read the final draft and you're so familiar with the film, it feels like it's been written for Jim Carrey as a character. Whereas in the original screenplay, it's a lot more dark. He has an alcohol problem. He There's a lot more violence in it. It doesn't have any of the kind of novelty advertising, you know, light entertainment moments that you get from the actual film. He doesn't have his catchphrase, which when you realise that, and then you imagine they get to the end of the story and go, oh, we need him to say something really cool when he exits. So it feels like they write him in this...
Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Was it good evening, morning?
Good, yeah.
And if I don't
good
see
morning,
you...
Good morning, good afternoon. Is it, I can't remember.
That's good morning too, and if I don't see you...
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
That's it, yeah.
Which is great. So I feel like that's how they wanted to like have this dramatic ending. So they've written it in several times earlier in the film.
Yeah.
Well, my understanding of these things from like, say, from operating on a smaller, lower budget level, often you're writing the thing and you're casting people both from behind the camera, in front of the camera. There's not that kind of, I guess, star factor often, so things don't get changed so much. But I guess in bigger things in Hollywood, there's the idea that, you know, people get attached to things, actors or directors or, you know, different stars. So then, yes, things will change depending on maybe who's involved and what they would bring to a project.
I was reading an article. It was titled something like, I wrote a Hollywood bomb or something like that. And it's basically this guy had written a horror film, this indie horror film, sold it to... just sold it, and then it was shelved for a few years. It was an independent film, and then I think a couple of years later it got rewritten, and it's like it was nothing how he ever imagined it would be when it got pen to paper, when it actually got down. It was like it totally ruined it, ultimately, from what his original idea was. So that's kind of, I think, if that it probably would beg the question, is that if things may get either modernised or something to suit that generation... Of audience and of what's happening in the world of pop culture and culture in general, really, doesn't it? That may have an impact.
Well, I mean, as a writer, how much control do you have once you've sold your screenplay?
Again, it depends on your level. Starting out, none. Often you could be hired or you could write something, get it bought off you or just taken off you. You wouldn't be on set, you wouldn't be in the edit. And then actually in film school, we had an exercise where there was a variety of different films being made, and I wrote one of them. But the deal was I wasn't allowed to direct or anything else, and that was my first experience of that. And I'd written a comedy that was taken off my hands, and the director read it as a drama. And so it's just awful. Oh, and it's because everything I wrote in jest was delivered
straight,
very sincerely. Wow. And it doesn't play off at all. And that was my first experience. And not saying that my writing was good. I'm sure there's plenty of problems with it. But my first experience of learning in how many places a film can go wrong. That you think, because it's quite difficult actually to identify when a film is, you know, potentially bad writing, bad acting, bad directing, badly shot, badly edited. It's like, it's quite it can go wrong in a lot of places, as it's, I think, our listeners are learning from our early attempts at this.
Well, at least we know that at some point it could be out of our hands. Mm. So it doesn't matter what we write now.
Yeah, fuck them.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I guess if you're Charlie Kaufman or one of the big Hollywood writers, Aaron Sorkin, once you get to a super writer level, then you have more control and you get to stay on the projects longer. And especially in TV now, the idea of showrunners, so each, with Game of Thrones and things like that, will have a team of writers, but they'll be all managed by a showrunner who's, for instance, I think Game of Thrones, if there's 10 episodes in a series, there's 5 writers doing 2 each. So it could be maybe one, you do episode 1 and episode 6 to give you the time. But then the showrunner's job is to even that all out to get a consistent voice. So it doesn't appear like 5 writers or again, it's 5 directors doing 2 episodes each. They have to equalise the show. So there's people now, the writers in television, I think, are kind of slightly kind of get more respect and more regard for their projects than film did historically, which is quite interesting.
Okay. Yeah, that is interesting. So, yeah, so that was my first experience of reading a script, or 3 scripts, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Recommend it to all.
But we did have some other recommendations.
Yep.
Pete's Low Life trailer.
Whoa.
That was
highly enjoyable.
That was, yeah, that was a feast for the eyes, wasn't it?
We should recommend more trailers, because they're very easy to watch.
Turned a bit much on.
So did anyone manage to watch Watership Down this week?
No, I did check out our Instagram page, so I have seen the animation that
Ryan
was talking about. Yeah, yeah. So, but I didn't get to rewatch the original film, sadly.
Because it wouldn't be what you remember from the original film, but I've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times, and it's firm favourite. So I didn't see it this week though. But that being said, it's sat on my phone, ready to watch maybe when I'm drunk later.
Nice.
Solid.
Equally, I didn't get around to watching Trainspotting, so let's breeze past that unless either of you did.
Well, I did watch some of it again, actually. Oh, nice. But I had seen that before. But yeah, great film, great script, great performances. Weirdly, on a seminar, I did read a little interview with one of the female cast members, who was saying it was just a crazy set as well, and that everyone was, you know, getting half the time they were drunk on set and they were doing all these crazy things. And in order to exercise every day, Ewan McGregor was running up the Edinburgh Steps. Oh, and wow. Like all these, apparently it was a bit of a mental shoot that kind of was mirrored in the film, which was, I thought, quite cool.
I heard it was actually on an interview for Trainspotting 2 that the picture of them at the front was done the day after the rap party.
Oh, really?
And everyone's massively, massively hungover or still drunk.
Nice.
And that was the, yeah.
I like that. It's a nice idea.
Yeah. Actually, because that's like a police lineup shot, isn't it? Kind of almost. It's not exactly, but they all kind of numbered and lined up, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's right.
And the other scene I always like with that is The Usual Suspects. That's one of my favourite scenes of all time, when all the boys are lined up in there.
Do you know why they're laughing?
Because I read about it, because it was... They did like a funny... It wasn't meant to be like that, and they were trying to make each other laugh or have an improv in it, and then Bryan Singer decided to keep it because it was better than...
Well, that voice you hear in the background shouting apparently is Bryan Singer, but apparently one of them farted.
Oh, really?
And that's what was made them laugh so much. So when you see that bit and they were like hitting each other and that lot, and Benicio Del Toro and Stephen Baldwin.
Yeah, fun gags.
What a fire.
It's so good.
But yeah, apparently that's why. Also, I mean, without massively ruining that film... I went to, when I was at drama school, Kevin Spacey came and did a talk, and he was talking about Singer and Usual Suspects and Gabriel Byrne, how much, like, Singer just didn't tell anyone who Kaiser Soze was. So when Gabriel Byrne basically found out it wasn't him, he kicked off, like, really got really fucking angry.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Nice.
There
you go.
Okay, so we had quite a big week last week with our first act episode, and we have started putting pen to paper this week. But in order to give ourselves a little bit of extra time, we're going to focus on dialogue and descriptive writing. Now, I know you guys have had a few ideas on the things that we touched on last week, but any thoughts that you want to bring to the table?
Well, for me, it was something we chatted about last week. As I started like dabbling and writing the script, we talked about the idea of holding off the reveal about the hate preacher, whether that was clear from the start or whether that was something to be revealed. But actually, when I got into things and I was looking at scripts like Magnolia and stuff again, my gut feeling was that everyone should be who they are from the start. A couple of reasons for this. I just don't think with so many characters and being multi-stranded, we'll have time to kind of have secrets and have reveal upon reveal. And actually, if only one or two of them have reveals like the hate preacher, who she really is, then yeah, I think it maybe is thrusting characters to the front a bit more when it feels like that was never the purpose of this. It was a multi-stranded narrative that everyone kind of shared it. So by making one person have a big reveal that they're not who they are, I think that unfairly thrusts them forward, which is, I kind of don't feel we want to do. And also the other thing that spoiled that for me was if we're going through people's house, in that opening scene with our big tracking shot, Steadicam shot, that people are who they are at home. Yeah. If we're going into the confines of their home and seeing their real life, she doesn't necessarily have to hide that in her house.
Yeah.
So I would think we'd see who everyone is from the start.
After I was thinking about this after we finished recording the other, on the last episode about Earl going from house to house. Something didn't sit necessarily right. And I think it kind of supports what you were saying there about us seeing what they're like and what they're like in their own lives. And I was thinking of a way that I was thinking more of sketch shows, in particular Monty Python, not the films, like the
Flying Circus stuff.
Yeah, the Flying Circus. They found a way of passing through each sketch from one thing to another, whether or not it was a sketch just joining onto another sketch, or it was the use of a television and you see one thing to another. And I think that would be a way for us to support the fact that the reveal isn't necessary, but also we get to see their home lives, but like passing quite nicely from one to the other. Does that make sense?
So maybe not using Earl as the device to transition between houses, but maybe using other household items as a way of transitioning.
Yeah, kind of. Not entirely. I think Earl serves a purpose, and even if it was a case of bookending, from one to the other. But if you know, a doorbell goes, for example, that's one way in, or you know, someone answering the door, someone's seen on surveillance, there are other things. It's just a way of it going in, you know. Yeah, if Kirsten Niebold is recording a YouTube clip, and then we're seeing her phone go down and a message pops up, or whatever it is, there's all those ways of doing that. And if we can find a way of bringing into still what's happening in the close and making it very about this small area, then that all the better. But that was my thought.
So I feel like you're almost suggesting that we flesh that out. So in my head, when we were having the conversation on the last episode, it felt like this was almost like an exaggerated theme opening. Do you know what I mean? It felt like it was just a big shot, but not necessarily lingering on any of the characters. Whereas I suppose if we don't have the time pressure of waiting for the post to be delivered, and we're just transitioning between the houses, then we can maybe stop on each house longer.
So it almost becomes, as opposed to one continuous scene, it's almost seven mini scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
I mean, it's just suggest, I think, I mean, at this point, it's, I guess the important focus is on what we see in those scenes. It's not dictated by what Earl necessarily sees. It's going back to what you were saying about hate preacher being a hate preacher in her house.
Mm.
What's more interesting is seeing hate preacher open a door, face goes to neutral, and she puts on her mask of being a normal, of being something. Do you know what I mean? But still, then we know we're in on the secret from the offset.
Yeah. So I suppose if we were looking to write a television show or something, and we had the time for each character to have its own reveal, then the way we were originally talking would make sense. But we need to be, so if I understand you correctly, we need our characters to almost be more transparent in their wants and needs and who they are, straight from the off.
Yeah, I just don't think we'll have the time otherwise. Our original ideas and everything we spoke about has never been about one character's big plot twist reveal.
Sure.
It was always about this group of people dealing with circumstances beyond their control. So I think that's, personally, that's my opinion. But people are who they are from the start. And they certainly can be revealed to each other, but to the audience, I think people should just be who they are.
Okay, yeah.
So, and then the other thing, it's not necessarily for Act One. The other thought I had, again, it was just when Ryan mentioned Earl. This is not to say we should definitely do this, but I just wondered whether actually he could be used as a better plot device, in that he could be almost a lock-in, or he could be an obstacle to the flower show, and that they would want him removed from the cul-de-sac for the show. I had this idea that something like, actually, if they're going to have a televised flower show that they want people to see, they don't necessarily, some of them certainly, maybe not all of them, but some of them wouldn't want a homeless man sitting in the middle of the green.
I 100% agree on that. I think that is a way of seeing people's
prejudices.
How people justify that prejudice.
And that's not to say remove him from the plot completely, because it's home, whether he's watching on from afar, or, you know, the end of the cul-de-sac, or, you know, what Earl does. I'm not saying get rid of him completely, but I'm sure there's scope for him to come back in somehow at the end. But that was my thought, that people actually, if they're hosting a televised show, would say, well, we got to get rid of Earl. It's not going to look good, him and his tent sitting in the middle of the street.
Yeah, and I suppose this also will end up kickstarting the conversation about when we start to reveal the major plot twist being the climate change phenomenon, because we did talk at one point about whether or not Earl might be one of the first people to fall victim to the heat, you know, living on the street, not having the shelter and the supplies of other people. So as to when that would even be brought to the fore,
but even if thinking about that, I mean, maybe jumping the gun a bit, but even if that wasn't the case, even if it was someone else who died, like, for example, what's the old lead?
Gerald.
No, the woman.
Valerie.
Valerie, yeah. I'm so shit with names. No, finger writing. If she died halfway through pruning her roses or something, and you weren't aware of her dying. Like that, you know, in Japan where the office workers just they work and work and work and then end up just
collapse at the
dead
desk.
Dead at their desk, yeah.
Yeah.
That type of thing. With the heat.
Yeah, no, that could be good. And actually, I was wondering then, saying about someone else has died first, again, this is further down the line, but whether being kicked out is actually Earl's salvation in the end, that actually being removed from the heat and everything else. Like,
or perhaps that, someone else could take, one of the characters you wouldn't imagine could invite him in.
Take him in, yeah. Mr. Fish.
Mr. Fish, perhaps.
That could be our spin-off series. Mikhail and Earl larking about.
Mr. Fish and the piano.
In a post-apocalyptic.
A post-apocalyptic thing.
Oh, I will have a cockablyptic. That is the worst.
Post-apocalyptic world. The two of them having the last.
Have you seen that Mel Gibson film, A Cockablypto?
The porno version.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so but that was our kind of that was just as the first pages were being written out, some of the stuff that came to me. But yeah, we'll be able to chat more about that next episode when we move on to Act Two. We'll do another quick review of what we've written. But it's actually happening.
It's great,
anyone isn't it? Worried listening yeah. in as to whether yeah. this was actually a real thing, pen has been put to paper.
So last week we said we would be focusing on dialogue and descriptive writing. But before we wanted to get into that, we had a few questions from our parents and other listeners about what do we use to do writing?
The technical aspects of writing.
Yeah. And having read a few scripts myself, there are certainly a few parts to it that I didn't fully understand, some of the notes and things. But first of all, I suppose, what do you use? Do you actually put pen to paper?
No, there is no pen to paper for most writers these days. Same. Old school typewriters, at least.
I've been going well wrong.
What have you been doing?
I've been using like charcoal.
Charcoal cave drawings.
Cave drawing, yeah. There's a cave right on the cliffs of Portsmouth that just has one of my stories.
Ah, how beautiful! There's a film in that.
There is a film in that.
Now, there is two ways that you can, I guess, in the industry that people write. The expensive one being software called Final Draft, but that's a hefty whack of a paycheck to get all of that stuff. And yeah, you'd have to be really into your writing to justify it and be doing it as a career, I guess. And the alternative, more accessible one, is a thing called Celtex, CELTX, which is an online kind of cloud-hosted writing software. And you can write on there and save it all online, and it will format everything for you as you go. Because if there is one thing for new writers starting out in the industry, don't ever, ever, ever write a script in Microsoft Word. If you send it to anyone who's an actor, a producer, a director, anyone, like, they'll put it in the bin.
Okay.
They'll poo on it.
Oh. It's all it is to them is excess toilet paper.
Yeah. Oh. And not nice toilet paper, like when you're at first school toilet paper.
It's like, yeah, that... like kind of plywood toilet paper. Yeah. Yeah.
Tracing paper toilet paper.
Tracing paper.
Plywood toilet paper.
You know what I mean? That like really like recycled stuff.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Like tears you in your arsehole as you go.
Plywood.
Plywood's probably a bit harsh, but.
Balsa wood.
Oh, yeah.
Some sort of soft wood.
It's going to poof on my model plane that I made.
But yeah, no, don't. For the love of God, do not do it. Because
okay.
It's like, I guess it's just. And it sounds harsh from people in the industry, but it's the first test of your professionalism that you've actually kind of looked up how to format a script, how it's done, that everything's in the right order, centered properly, et cetera, et cetera. And if you've not even bothered to look up how you write a script, people aren't going to be waste of time and to see what you've written.
Sure, that makes sense.
Mm. And there's so many, I guess there's so many writers, so many scripts floating around these days, just by sheer numbers alone, people are sadly looking for an excuse to not read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's another thing we could think about that is that if you were passing a script on to someone who is using the same software as you, as we've done before, T, it's a lot easier just to actually make notes and if you're sharing your work with someone, then it's everything is saved, like you say, everything is saved and everything is streamlined. And that's another reason why it's so great, why Celtex is great and why Final Draft is expensive but also very, very great.
Yeah, okay. So Celtex is free. So for anyone listening who is somehow writing along with us, that yeah, just go on there and do everything on there.
I'm going to download it after listening to this podcast.
There you go. That's first recommendation of the week.
That's a good recommendation.
Download Celtex.
So I guess other than my insightful observation that names are capitalised in scripts, there are also other features that seem to be consistent across most of the acts or the scenes in a script. Can you explain what the breakdown of those would be?
Well, actually, just with the names being capitalised, so the standard way is only the first time you use a name in descriptive writing is capitalised. For dialogue, they're always capitalised, but if you're using a person's name in the descriptive writing, only the first time you have to capitalise it.
Okay.
Every new character. And it's just a way for people when they're looking at a script at a later date and kind of, we call it in the industry, like breaking down a script. So you're working out what props you need, et cetera, they can just easily identify a new character each time by the use of capitals. So, but then after that, there's a few things which can be slightly weird to read the first time. Scene headings always start with INT. Or
int.
Int or ext.
Intext.
Intext. And that's either interior or exterior. Occasionally both if you're moving from inside to outside or vice versa.
Yep.
Okay.
So, but scene headings are interior, exterior, then the location. So for us at the moment, it'd be like interior, studio, and then day or night or time of day. So each scene heading has three little bits to it.
Okay.
But then after that, you're mainly into descriptive writing and dialogue. And then occasionally, the only other thing maybe worth mentioning, I know Ryan will have some thoughts on, is parentheticals, which are little brackets next to a section of dialogue if it needs to be said in a specific way. I guess that's the idea now with text messages and everything, when people occasionally misconstrue a text message, because the thing with reading a script out of context, you don't know sometimes how the lines are delivered, whether they're sarcastic or happy or sad, or things can be delivered in a variety of different ways. So it's a writer's attempt to clear up some of the context. But I can see Ryan's eager to jump in here.
From my experience, I would scrub out any parentheticals when I got a script because it can hem in a performance a little bit. It becomes quite prescriptive because that's what it is. It's prescribing a way to say the line or a way that character is thinking, and it's not entirely accurate for the performance. And it was just limiture.
Yeah, I'd back that up as a director as well. If you would, because I tend to write and direct my own work, so they can be helpful there, I guess, if you're doing your own stuff. But if you were to receive something from a writer, or if I was to send someone to another director as a writer, then, yeah, it's their choice whether to scrub that out or go with the writer's suggestion, because it's them directing the script with the actor. It's their decision how the lines are delivered, ultimately not the writer, sadly.
Okay. Do you think it would be better if you just used little emoticons next
easily
to every line?
Easily.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And there are loads of those, so you can be so very descriptive.
The turd emoticon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clears up any sentence. Yeah.
How should I do? Oh.
Aubergine. Yeah. So that's the main thing. And then another interesting thing about writing scripts, if you're ever on a film set, occasionally you'll see scripts with loads of different coloured pages in. And these are effectively, I believe it's certainly, there's a shooting script, so there's all the right in development and production companies as you're putting the script together, and it eventually get to a shooting script. But after that, further changes can be made. And those pages are added in with different colours. So if you go online, you can see there's a list. So the unrevised draft or the production draft, the shooting script will be all white. If you make a change, then you add in blue pages and then pink, then yellow, then green as different rewrites go on. And I think there's about 10 or 15 different colours. So it's just an easy visual way so people can see what the latest draft is. Or if someone sees a blue page and their script is all white, they'll think, oh, I'm missing a bit of rewrite.
Right.
So it's an easy way on set to see that everyone's working off the same thing. But it's an interesting thing the first time you're on a big set and you see all the different colours. And it could be, if you didn't know what that was, you'd be slightly disconcerted by it all, I think.
Or you just think that the person who's printing them off is just having a whale of time.
Yeah, we've all been there when we've run out of white paper.
What do I use?
You think, shit, I think I've got some old blue, arts and crafts paper upstairs.
Great
paper.
Throw
that together, yeah. So, that's another little thing that's helpful to know about scripts. So I guess they're the main technical aspects you need to know as a writer starting off. But as mentioned today, we're going to primarily be focusing on dialogue and the idea of some descriptive writing.
Exterior, edge of cornfields, day.
A pocket watch. Open. Ticking. Swinging from a chain. Held by a young man named Joe in a clearing beside a Kansas cornfield. Sky pregnant with rain. Waiting. He checks the watch, removes his earbud, headphones, stands. Without much ceremony, a bloodied man in a suit appears from thin air, kneeling before the young man. Hands and feet tied, burlap sack over his head, muffled screams, gagged. With no hesitation, Joe raises a squat gun and blows the man apart with a single cough of a shot.
Bang.
Pop. And the Rice Krispie kids.
Go home.
So, for anyone wondering what that was the opening scene of Looper. And yeah, but we thought we'd use that as a little example of some good descriptive writing. Mm. So the idea is you're trying to be as vivid and memorable as possible in the least amount of word count. Mm. Your descriptive writing doesn't want to be huge. It just needs to try and set the scene. And the best writers are really good at kind of boiling it down into what matters. And that's actually, yeah, quite a... certainly an engaging opening to the film.
Yeah.
And it gives you quite a lot of visuals, but in very short sentences, like that opening one, pocket watch, open, ticking, swinging from a chain. And you already get a really good visual sense, but in a very few words.
Yeah. Could you do one for hair right now?
Interior, garage, day.
Three men sit in a studio. They each have giant microphones in front of them. One looks slightly confused.
Bang.
This is Ashley. He owns the studio. But not for long. There you go. That's intriguing. I'd watch that.
I would watch it too.
But that's a good example of it. Other good writers for anyone listening, Tarantino's always a good one for but we talked about him too much on this podcast, but he's a great one for descriptive writing. But yeah, so it's just that those core visuals that really start your film. And good writers, the other thing, we were talking earlier about directors ultimately making the choices on visuals and how things are delivered, et cetera, but really good writers have the ability to like write and force shots upon the director, which is really interesting. Newer writers, that the idea that they might say, they might open a scene saying, close up of some eyes. And then they're
classic.
trying to force the director to start with a really tight shot on someone's eyes. But maybe a more experienced writer would say, like, Ashley's eyes narrowed. And then, like, something like that really draws focus to a particular visual or picture description without actually telling you what shot it is.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, good writers have the ability to kind of write the film in shots without you realising it.
I think it'd be really handy if that happened to you in real life. I'd love it if it was just a narration in my head that told me what I needed to do.
Actually, weirdly say that, it's a really, really, really powerful exercise to do if you're struggling with action, is just to walk through something and say it out loud and then just take out what the key words are. Because if you read that back on the Looper one, that is shot by shot. I would see a watch. I would see it ticking. I would see a guy taking his earphones out. And everything is there.
Well, it's interesting. I've helped other people read certain scripts before, and you get a 120-page script that actually, when it's written properly, would probably be 100 pages because you can just trim so much of the description. It's where people go, not wrong, but where people overwrite starting out. So I think it's something we definitely got to be careful about with our script.
Yeah.
And first drafts always tend to be overwritten, but you can certainly delete. And I remember when starting out, I used to be like, he stands and walks over to the way, like, you describe every movement. Yeah. He blinked, he did this, he did that, and you're actually, no, this is completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
So, and actors and directors will find that in the rehearsals, in the performance anyway. So you can trim down all the stuff you think you need and just keep the core stuff. I think Looper's a good example there of some good descriptive writing. So I guess we have to try and apply that, practice what we preach and apply that to our own script. So maybe a bit of homework for the next couple of weeks. Will we say we'll try and write the opening couple of paragraphs, the opening descriptive thing of our whole film? We'll get it up on our website and across social media in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little challenge for ourselves. We don't want to throw the whole script up, obviously, but it might be a nice little teaser.
Sure, maybe we can get some like kind of rough guide imagery up there as well.
Yeah,
to
that
what
might
we
be
think
nice.
The cul-de-sac looks like.
A visual treatment.
A little aerial shot of the cul-de-sac where people are living and everything else like that, along with the opening descriptive lines.
Lovely. Nice.
So, yeah, so people can get a taste for our own script and the descriptive writing that applies to it.
So, yeah, that sounds really great.
Cool.
And I think we should probably dive into dialogue now.
Yeah, so that's what we promised. That's the other massive, massive part of any script. So, yeah, let's go for it.
So what makes, in your opinion, guys, what makes good dialogue?
Words.
Words is good, yeah. I'm a big fan of words in dialogue.
So I think there's a few things. I did a bit of research on this because I think it's, I mean, everyone can, we all talk, is what we're doing now and everything else like that. So it's the idea that everyone thinks they can do it, but actually, right, film dialogue is not real life dialogue. Good film dialogue is disguised as that, but it's actually every scene, every word in the film has a purpose. It's all driving towards something. Whereas, as this podcast clearly shows, a lot of what we do is idle chit-chat. Whereas in a film, everything is thought through.
How very dare you?
Everything is driving towards
everything
something.
Everything through this morning.
Everything that we say is driving towards the next thing that we say. It just might not be very linear.
It's not the cul-de-sac of conversation, this podcast. It's a more winding road. But,
a roundabout, I feel.
In film, you just, every sentence is driving towards something. So it's not entirely like real-life dialogue is the first thing I'd say. Secondly, I guess the other important thing, and I'm sure Ryan has thoughts on this from the acting side, is every character has to have a really distinct voice. Okay. And it's not something I've been criticised with my writing on in the past. It's very easy to write everyone the same. There's always a good exercise I heard that actually what you should be able to do when you have your script is delete all the names and read it and you still know who's talking. Because everyone has a really distinct voice and a really...
And I assume that means that you're not just writing in different accents.
No, not to be confused with accents.
Because people talk like that.
Baby Nebot, clear to identify. But no, not accents or not kind of, that they're speaking a different language or anything. It's just, they're easily identifiable by their style and their own distinct way of talking. And that can be a variety of things, whether they're very, succinct or whether they're long and rambling like myself or everyone, but you should be able to identify people by their dialogue alone as opposed to needing a name to go with it.
That is so hard. That is like
it's incredibly hard.
The problem is that the way people write, like you say, is that it's how they think people should say things. But if you just have the conversation that you want to have in the scene with someone else and make a note of how that's said. And that's one real powerful way of writing, I think, anyway. Rather than going, I need to get this amazing word into this scene, into this person's... Yeah, that fucking...
And as I think as Ryan is demonstrating here, you've also got to be careful how long any specific person talks for.
I went off on one then. Sorry.
Again, script writing can be very visual as well. If you look at a page and it's just one person talking, you can be pretty sure that that's probably... too long for any one character. Good dialogue is often back and forth, and variety of people talking and saying their points succinctly, again all driving towards something. I guess if one person just rambling on, not to say there isn't times for a good monologue or something like that, but if you have one character just going on and on and on, then it's probably not going to be the best of writing.
I think you'll find the best ever monologues that you see on a film, not theatre. Theatre's slightly different, but on a film is shown by watching the person who's listening. And there's kind of a film school, kind of a go-to scene for this that I'm sure most film school students know, which is in Good Will Hunting between Robin Williams and Matt Damon. And Robin Williams, they're sat on a bench, and Robin Williams is basically just telling him what he thinks of him, without the pretense of being a psychiatrist or anything like that. And the camera is rarely on Robin Williams. Most of it is on Matt Damon, just listening to to all of what's being said. And that shows the impact of a good bit I'm not a massive fan of monologues all the time, as long as you can see that listening side of it. Mm. Outside of that, it just looks like someone's droning on a lot of the time.
Yeah,
you switch off.
No, exactly, the audience switch off to really long bits of, like we do in real life. Yeah. You just switch off to someone talking too much.
So just coming off the back of what you were saying there about not wanting to have a monologue that's too long or have too many pages, it made me think of Jaws, directed by Mr. Spielberg and based on Peter Benchley's novel, Mr. Spielberg.
Oh, right.
Do you know him?
Mr. and Mrs. Spielberg's son.
Oh, yeah. I think I know him.
He's done at least three book film, picture book films.
Yeah.
Picture book films.
Yeah.
Flicks books.
He's done a few. And so we all know the scene, I think, the scene where they're all drunk and they're sharing, swapping their war stories and showing each other their wounds, metaphysical and physical wounds. Interesting anecdote I was reading was that it was Howard Sackler, who was uncredited at the time, but later acknowledged by Stephen as being the chap that came up with the idea that Quint was on the USS Indianapolis when it was sunk after delivering the bomb, and they were all picked off by sharks. It was all a bit scary. And then that idea was handed to a writer, John Milius, who delivered to Spielberg a 10-page monologue that was then handed off to Robert Shaw, and he was allowed to basically hone it down to whatever he wanted. And another interesting fact was that he asked to deliver that actually drunk, and it was terrible, and they had to cut it and reshoot it.
Yeah.
And then he nailed it, yeah.
Nice.
So I like that.
That's a bold move for dialogue, deliver drunk.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, he wanted to be...
Here's 10 pages, get drunk and cut it down the five.
The end.
Win. Thanks, Robert Shaw.
But that seemed really unusual to me that you would, and I guess he obviously had credit to his name at that point that he was allowed to do that. But
yeah, I mean, he's big gravitas, isn't he, Robert Shaw? And he'd done a lot. He'd worked with Pinter, Harold Pinter, and especially on The Caretaker, and has quite iconic monologue in that. So I can only imagine that he would understand pace and tone. I mean, you say it's iconic. You can't forget that scene, and you're totally drawn into that story, and it's horrible, and it's vivid. So I think probably would have been a collaboration, and if Spielberg done that, what was it, 78? No, later than that.
The book was 74.
So
I think it was a couple of years later.
So if he'd done that, how many films has Spielberg done by that point? He's still fairly young.
Done at least three.
So he was probably that gone. Let's just collaborate and see what's going to happen as well.
It would be interesting as well to know what stage that was done at, because I guess the thing is, when you're working with actors on a bigger film, long term, they start to inhabit the character more so than you ever can as a director. Mm. Especially, for instance, things like method actors, I guess, like idea. I think we spoke about four people like Daniel Day-Lewis and Joaquin Phoenix and all that, when they really like inhabit a character, that there's a certain point where they, I guess, they potentially accelerate past you and overtake you as a director, where they know it more than you. And it's interesting, I know some directors, Shane Meadows, I believe, he does a lot of his scripts based on improv. And so there's other scripts written where they get at, and you know, you have to have the time and money to do this, but you get actors in a room with a loose guide to all your scenes, and you throw their wants and needs at them and what motivates them and the context of the scene, and then they film the rehearsals. Yeah. So they rehearse it, and they're improving lines, and they take all that footage away and they write the script based off the improvs.
Yeah. Oh. The most famous one for that is Mike Leigh's Vera Drake. Characters would never meet for a lot of it. And they spent, there's quite a massive turning point in the film, and they spent I think it was 7 or 8 hours having this Christmas, it was just like a party around Christmas time, not knowing what was about to happen. And it was rehearsed like that in one big improv. They had all the dialogue down from that, and then I think it's probably a week later or a week or two later they went onto set. It's definitely not cheating writing that way. It's that idea of that there has to be a humanity in dialogue, and there has to be something there. So if someone can actually deliver that and find their own way inhabiting that character. Say what you want about people like method actors doing that method stuff, but if they embed that and then they have the dialogue there, a director and a writer is going to go, that's how it should be said. What a great one, though. What a great one for dialogue. There's loads of great dialogue in that. Famous line, Tina, do you want to say it?
Ah, it's a shark.
That's my favourite bit.
I presume you're talking about we're going to need a bigger boat.
No, I wasn't talking about that.
I was talking about a shark.
It's a shark. improv. Improv's put in the script.
And yeah, so do you have any, Ryan, do you have any particular films that stand out with the dialogue for you?
There's one, it was a play as well, but it was a film called Doubt. There's a great scene between Meryl Streep and Viola Davis, and which shows clear like objective and wants from their characters, but it's only really achieved based on a lot on the dialogue, because it's so concise and so quick. So that would be my recommendation if you want to watch a film that's on just for really understanding dialogue as well. It's Doubt. I think it's by John Patrick Shanley, I think, or Neil Patrick Shanley. John Patrick Shanley.
No, I've not seen that. I'll definitely look that one up.
It's a good film. It's about nearly 10 years old, but it's a good film.
Excellent.
What about
you, T? So a couple that stand out for me. One was No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film. And Javier Bardem plays the killer there.
He's scary, isn't he?
He's a very scary man.
Scared me.
But he doesn't say much in the film. It's a while since I've seen it, but I was looking at the scripts. But he doesn't say too much, does he, as a character? But I was thinking particularly of the scene that jumped to my head was the gas station scene. With flipping the coin.
Flipping the coin, yeah.
And he says a couple of good lines. This coin's been travelling 22 years to get here, and now it's here, and it's either heads or tails, and you have to say, call it. The guy says, look, I need to know what I stand to win. And he just says, everything.
Yeah.
That was a great bit of dialogue.
Oh, man.
Such an intense scene. But yeah, really like summed up the character well, what he wants. Really snappy, really ominous and terrifying, and everything you want from good dialogue.
I think we're missing quite an important actor who has some amazing dialogue in nearly all of his films.
Charlie Chaplin.
Well, that's a good one, though.
Thanks.
Schwarzenegger.
Schwarzenegger, yeah.
Do you happen to know any of his quotes, Ryan?
A couple.
Oh, please.
I like the one...
Get to the chopper!
It's amazing. Get to the chopper. Direct tells you where you want you to go. And you go. Yeah. Get to the chopper. Or see you at the party, Richter. He's got a guy's hands, arms in his hands, been chopped off.
He can't get to the party.
See you at the party. He's on the floor, isn't he?
His accent's changing as it's going.
Do it. Fuck you. Oh, anything he says, it doesn't matter. You know, dialogue is. I mean, I guess that's more catchphrases, isn't it? But it's still dialogue, you know? And it's memorable.
Yeah.
Yeah, good catchphrase. I mean, that'll stand the test of time, won't it?
Hmm.
Do you think we'll be able to
like,
get...
shark!
No, I'm sure we can come up. I think Mr. Fish has a great catchphrase in him.
Yeah. Bring me my weather map.
But you do... That's the thing. If someone can't remember a film, or they know a film, they might remember a line from it and they'll try and say it poorly and you'll have to work out what it is.
Is that any day hanging out with you?
Yeah. You know that film?
You know that with the name? The one with the words.
Well, the word film.
One other one that stood out for me with dialogue was a show called The Leftovers.
Oh, no.
I'm fucking digging my heels in after being shot down last week.
5 weeks.
You're not.
Six episodes.
Oh, I've got such a good bit of dialogue from The Leftovers.
Do you know, every week...
Is it the end?
No, it's not the end. It's from the pilot, but it sums up everything beautifully.
For the love of God.
Should we let him say it? I'm happy to say
lovely,
no.
It's a moment I've met a reference before. It's Nora Durst's.
If you've referenced it before,
already referenced
that you've got, it's like,
but I mean, like, this is your remit. I feel like I'm painting a picture here. Like I've talked about the character,
and you've got left
the intro scene, and now I've got the dialogue to complete it.
Well, start your own podcast.
Oh, it's so fucking good.
Every week we have we sit
you've
around.
You've turned everyone off The Leftovers. No, even I've watched it, and I'm turned off from The Leftovers.
I stopped watching it.
Unbelievable.
Actually, there's good dialogue in it. I'll give you that.
I'm not still not going to.
There was also.
It's a beautiful monologue.
Because like I think another good one which we haven't mentioned that much, maybe mentioned earlier on a few episodes, is Mulholland Drive gets some quite decent bits of dialogue in it, especially in the audition scene.
It's weird though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel bad for not letting Tiernan talk about.
I feel a little. I feel he looks. His head's down.
Yeah, he looks like he's crying.
He's
smiling, but he's crying.
He looks like Charlie Brown walking across in the scene.
Since the first episode, though, I have tried to. I've always wanted to talk about with Nell and I because that's my favourite film that I mentioned, and you know, I thought, and I've mentioned it once, so let's not be that guy. But I'm going to now. Have you guys seen it?
I haven't seen it for so long.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Wow, that's a shame. Go watch it so that we can talk about
it. I will actually stand by that one, and I'll by next episode, I'll watch With Nan and I.
Yeah, I'll do With Nan and I in Doubt. I'll put myself out there.
Me and Tina and all them, we'll sit in a room and watch it together.
Do.
Because if I turn the DVD player on or Blu-ray player on and notice that the case feels loose and there's a leftovers DVD sitting there, I'm going to be so upset.
Another good example that I thought of was 12 Angry Men, written by Reginald Rose.
Mm.
Ah. One of my all-time favourite go-to hangover movies.
Is it?
Yeah, just love it. Love
I
it.
Didn't know that.
Don't have, it's not, you know, there's what, three different shots? It's predominantly, what, 90% in the room?
That's true.
It's not, you know, but in terms of dialogue, it's phenomenal. There's some brilliant writing on show, but it's a great example of how silence can be used as a powerful response. I think.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Intriguing. So could they also be faded out?
I think they. Well, I think they would have liked to. So it's that scene with Juror 10 where he's ranting, he's going on his big tirade of prejudice, and one by one the jurors all stand up and turn their backs to him until who's the lead character? Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
Kind of explains how all they need to do is find a reasonable doubt and. It's phenomenal. All they're doing is standing up one by one, but it's a really, really powerful scene.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think they would have loved to have been able to slowly turn him down.
Unbelievable.
Just gone home.
Yeah, just gone home.
Don't worry about it.
Well, my final one from the other end of the scale is one of the best comedies ever. I'm sure lots of people have seen as Anchorman, which I think is incredibly funny.
Yeah.
Great, great dialogue. Sex Panther, 60% of the time, it works every time, being one of my favourite lines. And that's another interesting way to do dialogue. We spoke about improv already, but obviously on comedies like that, they can often just set up and position the actors, and then the directors will just get them to improv or deliver a variety of jokes or ends to a line that they can pick the best one in the edit.
Mm.
So they'll just keep on being in position doing punchline, 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 punchline.
Bridesmaids is another one that's very much like that, and yeah.
Yeah, if you just go online on YouTube, you can watch outtakes of things like that, them just doing different endings to the same joke, and you'll see all the ones that didn't make the cut, and it's always quite interesting to see that that's sometimes how they do comedy dialogue. And I believe that's why Lord and Miller have recently been fired from Star Wars, isn't it? Because they rely heavily on improv, and they were encouraging a lot of that on set, and apparently it wasn't ultimately sitting too well with the bigwigs.
Oh, right.
So that's why they were kicked off. Because they like to keep it super loose on set and have lots of improv and lots of jokes and everything else like that. So, yeah. So it's interesting. There's loads of different ways to do it, as with anything in film.
Mm.
So, yeah. So, but again, I guess in trying to some way apply all this discussion to our own piece, the real challenge we've set ourselves, like I said earlier, is giving each character distinct voices. And by having a multi-stranded piece, we've really created a challenge for ourselves by coming up with 7 or 8 clear, distinct voices. I guess some people lend themselves more to silence. I imagine Mikhail Rybakov, Mr. Fish, is a man who's very, picks his words. Yeah.
Sure.
Certainly, I guess if he was a weatherman, he'd have to have some sense of delivery. I imagine he'd have quite a good delivery, for instance, if he's been a weatherman and been on television in the past delivering things with authority. But maybe, whether that's been eaten away by the experience he's had. So now he's, in his personal life now as a result of what's happened, he's very much a man of few words and keeping himself to himself. The hate preacher, what the dialogue she's, presenting to the rest of the cul-de-sac versus what she'll say on stage in front of her chosen audience. She definitely is personally has interesting dialogue to be played with. Young Kirsty Niebolt and our internet troll, I guess they'd have, a more young person's sense of dialogue. I get that's another challenge with writing, I guess, how timeless you're trying to make it by using particular words that might be, appropriate time.
So they can't go, hey man, wiggity wiggity whack.
Exactly. Yeah.
Say shit like that and be like, well,
yeah, that's not going to stand the test
boss.
Of time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's really neat.
You're so 2019.
There.
So, watching Dazed and Confused last week, you could tell that dialogue was from that time. It's definitely a lot of words in there that, wouldn't apply now. Mm. So we've got to be careful of that. The Leds then would be the opposite end of the scale. They'd have potentially slightly more old school speaking manner.
Country
might be very, yeah, might be very polite, very uptight, very. So, I mean, that's hopefully the good thing where we'll find our voices from is the idea that they're such distinct characters from a wide range of backgrounds, cultures, age scale, that we can hopefully find the voice through that. Because otherwise, it's going to be a real challenge to keep them, you know, as individuals. So, yeah, and Earl, maybe Earl just sings everything.
I'd love that. Going down to the cul-de-sac. I got me no money. I have a piano. It's quite heavy. Wow, we have definitely gone off the beaten track.
I was going to say, all our keep it short and concise, and then we just waffled.
Waffled like a Belgium lunch menu.
I was wondering where you're going with that. Nice.
Thanks.
Nice. Great wordplay.
Thanks. Thanks. So recommendations are, just to recap on that, yours were Tiernan?
Mine was No Country for Old Men, and Ash was, you were, with Nell and I.
And I'm going to go with that nice, joyous, happy film, Doubt.
Yeah, and actually, and again, having discussed our technical stuff, of writing earlier, I believe if anyone hasn't read a script yet, I'd recommend that again. Our first double recommendation of the series. Mm. I would certainly suggest, you know, if you're interested in going on this journey with us, it's a really nice thing to do is read a script. And you can download them as a PDF on your phone or on a tablet or whatever and just have a flick through on your, you know, on a train journey or wherever you need.
Not when you're driving.
Yeah. Don't read and drive.
As always, we'll end with just reminding you where we can be found in the ether. If you go to our lovely website of www.taffit.co.uk, you'll also find a link to the Truman Show script that I couldn't be bothered to find properly.
And actually, and as promised, we will, over the next couple of weeks, some point we'll have up our opening description for the film along with a visual of our cul-de-sac. Keep an eye out for that on Instagram and our website.
And don't forget, you can tweet to us on @afilminthat. Or write to us at theresafilminthat@gmail.com.
And as I say, next week, we mentioned this before, but we will be venturing into Act 2.
Mm.
Along with a little bit more reviewing of Act 1, probably. But hopefully, we'll have our first few pages in the bag.
The ball bag.
And we also have a little extra surprise for you all coming up this week. Following the success of Mr. Pete Appleyard's first interview here on the last episode of the podcast, this week we will be releasing a supplementary interview to accompany the episode with writer-director Sasha Bennett, who kindly gave us some of his time to talk about his career, experiences and writing process. So keep an eye out for that.
Oh, I am... Here I am, hung over to Jeff, surveying the damage of my wine and cheese soiree at my mum's bungalow while she sees her sister in Swansea back at 3 p.m. I do a quick recce before fixing my brekkie, eggs Benedict and a Bloody Mary. Bathroom's clean, lounge looks cleaner, the only thing missing is a case of Fleury. Last place I checked, mum's favourite chair broken, sits in the solarium. Keith, so Larry, man, what did you do, you moron? You sat down too hard.
Got to find some to fix mum's rats and chair from Manila. Looks like wicker, I'm out on my ass. If I can't find a fixer, need a specialist. Not anybody, only if they deal with this hand-twisted flat rattan. Read herringbone pattern, pattern, pattern.
I fire up the Mac and I go on Google. I find a chair fixer and call the number. A lady answers, I give her the sitch. Says she's on her way, no delay, that's good, isn't it? Without hesitation, she's straight to the sunroom. I can't help thinking, but I know her from somewhere. Maybe it's the Royals. Then it comes to me. It's Ripley from Alien 1, 2 and 3. Don't you do films, I ask. She says nothing and just carries on with the task. I want to make sure. I need to test her. IMDb knows our Galaxy Quester.
Got to find someone to fix mum's rats and chair. Manila looks
looks like wicker. I'm out on my ass if I can't find a fixer. Need a specialist, not anybody, only if they deal with this hand twisted flat rattan. Read herringbone pattern, pattern, pattern.
I'm pretty sure I saw you in a bunch of films like Political Animals and Red Lights, even Cabin in the Woods, Gorillas in the Mist, that blue thing in Avatar, Chappie, Exodus, Gods and Kings, Abduction, all those things. You were in there, weren't you? Oi, Sigourney, you listening? Baby Mama, Be Kind Rewind, Tales from Despero, Vantage Point, you the voice in Wally. Oh, and you did that Happily Never After. You've done so many films. Why are you weaving chairs? Chairs, 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 chairs. 30 minutes passed, she moves from the chair. It's perfect. Sigourney Weaver just fixed my mum's rattan chair in record time. She walks past me and gives me a wink. I know it's her. She knows it's her. I don't know what to think.
Gone and found someone to fix mum's rattan chair from Manila. Looks like wicker. It's like new. It's straight from a picture. If you need a specialist, who you gonna call with a problem like this? Ghostbusters, they're leaving. Call Hugo and Weaver's weaving. Gone and found someone to fix mum's rattan chair from Manila. Looks like wicker. It's like new. It's straight from a picture. If you need a specialist, who you gonna call with a problem like this? Ghostbusters, they're leaving. Call Hugo and Weaver's weaving.
She hands me a card and an invoice. I look down. It says Hugo Weaving's Weavers. Wait, does Hugo Weaving work for you as well? I do nothing. She's already gone. Back to the cheese.
Gone and found someone to fix mum's rattan chair from Manila. Looks like wicker. It's like new. It's straight from a picture. If you need a specialist, who you gonna call with a problem like this? Ghostbusters, they're leaving. Call Hugo and Weaver's weaving.